Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to a ScaryCast extra special tonight. I'm Dr. John Stamey, live from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and we have got a wonderful co-host and an incredible guest. You just can't imagine how much fun we're going to have tonight if you are into the paranormal. So first of all, I want to introduce my co-host, Elijah Henderson. How are you doing tonight, Elijah?
My friend, I'm doing well tonight. I'm alive and kicking, and yeah, I'm happy to be here and talking with our guest tonight. He sounds like he's going to be a really interesting feller.
Well, that's great. Now, tell everybody just a little bit about yourself and your family and kind of how you built your reputation up around basically the land of the lakes and beyond. Land between the lakes, I'm sorry, and beyond.
Okay, that's a potentially long answer, but I'll try to condense it as best as I can.
My name
is Elijah Henderson. my name is Elijah Henderson. I run the Cryptid Studies Institute that was founded by my dad, Johnny Henderson. And he is the big reason why I'm into cryptozoology today, because when he was a little boy, our family from over in East Tennessee would pass down stories to him of their experiences with Sasquatch in the mountains, and I won't get into that tonight, but they would share all these different stories, pass it down to him, and that always stayed on his mind. And eventually, we all went to a place, which is going to be, I assume, mentioned tonight, over in Dixon, Tennessee, called Werewolf Springs, and again, I won't get into that right now, but basically, we had an experience of sorts there. And it got us all involved into cryptozoology. We joined a group that gathered up in East Tennessee over around Standing Stone State Park called Chattahoochee Bigfoot Organization. If y'all are familiar with Mary Green, the famous Bigfoot researcher, she was a big part of that group. And really that's how we got started, I got started. And over the years, we slowly dipped our toes into dogman research. We used to think it was a misidentified Bigfoot, but as reports started coming in of something that genuinely appears to be like a werewolf in appearance, we realized that it was something different altogether. So we started exploring and researching Land Between the Lakes, where I'm sure everybody is, or largely everybody is familiar with the infamous story of the family that was attacked and killed in the 80s by what people believe to be a dogman. We've researched that a lot, done quite a bit of research on the ground up there in different places, and there does seem to be something up there, but that's probably what our organization is best known for at the time. We're always in Land Between the Lakes doing something, and it's a good spot for research, but the condensed edition of how I got involved with all this and who I am.
Well, we're certainly glad to have you here co-hosting. It's a lot of fun. The paranormal is a lot of fun to me because it brings together legends, stories, people's experiences, and those are things that you really can't discount. Regardless of what people say, regardless of these skeptics that say, oh, we don't believe it. Well, you know what? People have these stories, and too many people have too many stories to discount. At least that's what I think. So anyway, thank you for that. And now we would like to introduce our guest, Justin Spurlock. Justin, how are you doing tonight?
I'm good. How are you guys doing?
We're doing great. All right, tell us
great,
a little bit. First of all, tell us a little bit about yourself. What do you do for a living, and what are you interested in? We're going to like move from there to some of our great stories. So tell us a little bit just about yourself, okay?
Awesome. Well, first off, thank you so much for inviting me to be on the show tonight. I truly appreciate it. I live in Dixon County, Tennessee. For those who are listening who are not familiar with the Middle Tennessee area, we're right outside of Nashville, probably about 30 to 40 miles just to the west of Nashville. And I'm a high school history teacher. I teach United States history, government, economics, world history, things like that over at the local high school here in Dixon County. And so I sort of gained a love of history when I was younger and decided to, you know, get into that in my professional life. So my day job, I'm a history teacher. I also dabble in real estate a little bit. My family owns a real estate company. But really what I do for fun, and I guess what probably connected me with you fellas, is I like to write. I'm a writer. It's something I love to do, and I really like to write local history stories, specifically local here to the Nashville area and specifically to Dixon County where I live. I actually live in a small town called Burns, Tennessee, and if you were to look that up on a like Google Maps or something like that, you would notice that Burns is really close to what's Montgomery Bell State Park, and I actually live right on the edge of the park here, and I grew up in the park, and I grew up here in Dixon County hearing a lot of really interesting stories. And a couple of years ago, I started to kind of dabble in writing up some things, you know, as being a historian and a history teacher and doing a lot of the research that I do. Naturally, you're going to want to write some of that stuff down to share with other people. So I started writing local history stories and, you know, about, you know, how the town of Dixon got started or how the town of Burns got started or how our county was formed, things like that, just little tidbits. But what I found that people what I come to learn that people found the most interesting were the sort of what we would call maybe spooky or scary stories. And so about a year ago, I really started to want to write down some of these old legends that I'd heard about here locally, and that's sort of how I got my start with the newspaper. So I write an article every Wednesday in the Dixon Post. It's our local newspaper here, and I've been doing that for about a year. But really what got me popular and got me the weekly article, was three stories that I wrote about a year ago, and they were all scary stories. One of them was called Werewolf Springs, and it was about a werewolf. And then one was called the White Bluff Screamer, or the White Screamer, which was about, you know, a creature. And then another one about a ghost in on Main Street in downtown Dixon that several people had claimed to have seen. And so, like I said, I enjoy just local history and stuff. But those stories that I wrote, which are based in complete facts from people that I knew that had told me the stories growing up, and then I was able to go out and sort of find some older people. You know, I'm 38 years old, but there's some fellas that are in their 60s, 70s, 80s who know these stories, and I was able to interview some of them, and I was able to jot down that information. And since then, those articles have been read. I was looking at my Facebook algorithms and statistics and things like that, and one of those stories was read over 50,000 times. So they were getting shared and shared and shared, and people were finding this stuff to be really interesting. And so I'm really glad you guys contacted me, because these stories – you know, they're like local legends here to the Burns, Dixon County, and like the Middle Tennessee, Nashville area. But a lot of people don't know about them, and so I'm just really excited that you guys were able to, you know, find me and bring me on the podcast here so that we could kind of talk about this stuff, so I could kind of get it out and see if it connects with some of these other things that, you know, people have kind of always told me about.
You know, it's really funny that you say that, because do you really know how we found you?
No, I'm not exactly sure. Fill me in.
Your stories. Because what happened was, I had been talking with Elijah. I talk with him a couple of times a week. And we talk about spooky stories and all this stuff. And so I Googled up White Bluff Screamer, and an article from the Tennessean came up, and then your article came up. So, of course, I went to your article first because you looked more local. And I have notes on I printed out a copy of your article, and I have notes saying, I got to call this guy. I've got to talk to him. This is great. And so that is exactly how we found you, is because of your stories. And they're a little bit legendary, I'll tell you that. So what I'd like for you to do is I'd like for you to tell us the story of the White Bluff Screamer. And I'm not going to call it a legend, because I'm a paranormal researcher. I've spent 3 years doing research at the Ryan Research Institute, the old Ryan Institute of Parapsychology. And I have learned that when enough people talk about a story, it's more likely to be real than not. And I tend to believe what people say, especially, you know, if they come out and say it in front of in front of everybody. And that's what I think is important. So tell us about the White Bluff Screamer. And I've got a couple of questions for you, and I know Elijah probably will have some questions for you too. So, sir, Dustin, you are on deck. Let's go.
Awesome. Well, let me tell you the story about this White Screamer. But in order to really tell you the story, I kind of have to give you a little background information kind of about my area so you'll kind of understand how things work here. So Dixon County is not a very big county. Like I said a little bit earlier, we're about 30 or 40 miles just to the west of Nashville. And really, if you go back about 100 years, maybe 150 years, there really wasn't a lot out here. The real reason that the towns in this little part of our county began to form was because there was a railroad built during the Civil War. So between 1861 and 1865, the railroad was built through Dixon County. Now, the reason the railroad was built was to help the Union Army to get supplies to Nashville. It's kind of a long story. I won't bore you with that. But I want you to kind of understand what's kind of going on here. So the railroad gets built in the 1860s. And then sometime in the 1870s, some weird things really start to happen around Dixon County. And I know this is an audio podcast, but if you'll take a look at a map and you'll see just west of Nashville, you'll see that there's a few towns in Dixon County. One of them's called White Bluff, and the other one is called Burns. And then, of course, if you keep going a little further west, you'll hit Dixon, which is the big town, the big city here in Dixon County. Well, right after the Civil War in the 1870s, there was a traveling circus that was coming through this area. And there were some weird people and some weird creatures that were involved in this circus. And there's always been stories and legends and oral history that's been passed down that say that sometime in the 1870s there was a train crash, and this circus had several cars full of, like I said, creatures and people and things, and it crashes. And they're not really able to find all of the circus attractions, I guess you could say, some of these animals and some of these people. Now, they're able to find most and put them back on the train and continue on to the next city. But there was always – I was always told that there was some different things, and I'm not really sure what those things were, but some different things that might have escaped at that time and kind of hung out around this area. So, you know, I don't know too much about that, but that's sort of the background on this story. Now, some weird things start happening in Burns, right around Montgomery Bell State Park, where the railroad sort of goes right on the edge of the park. And then in the 1920s, some really weird things start happening in the town of White Bluff, which is just about 10 miles away from Burns. Now, the story that I wrote starts off in the 1920s. And this is a story that I've been told all of my life. And I've grown up and lived in this area pretty much my whole life, other than when I went to college. And so it starts off in the 1920s, and there's a creek in White Bluff called Trace Creek. And Trace Creek runs pretty much all the way from White Bluff, if I remember correctly, and it dumps into, I think, the Harpeth River, which goes into the Cumberland River, which is the river that Nashville is on. And around this creek, there were some haulers. And there were some people that began to move to this area and set up residences and build houses in this holler. Well, in the 1920s, in the hollers of Trace Creek, near the old town of White Bluff, there was a small country house right near the creek where a man and his wife and their seven children lived. And so they had been living there for a while. And after a while of living there, they began to hear strange noises. And from what I've been told, it sounded like an animal, but resembled the screams of a young girl. So they thought, you know, they thought the sounds that they were hearing were coming from an animal, but when they would try to describe it to someone else, they would say that it sounded like the shrieks of a young girl. And that's what I'd always, you know, been told about it. But they didn't know what these howls and these screams were, but they kept coming from the nearby woods, and they continued night after night. Now, this man had seven children, and his children would become very scared, and they couldn't sleep. And so after a while, the man, I think, began to become somewhat annoyed with this crazy sound coming from the woods, and I think he was wanting to put a stop to it so that his family, you know, could have some peace. And so, you know, He's not sure what to do. He's really becoming frustrated. He wants his family to have peace. He wants people to be able to sleep. He starts thinking maybe he should go after whatever it is out there in the woods and at least see what it is, maybe kill it. You know, who knows really what his motivations were, but he was really wanting to do something about this, I guess, annoying noise that his family kept hearing. So before going to bed one night, he started hearing the screams again. And I guess the old man had had enough. So he grabbed his gun, and he took off into the woods, vowing to kill the animal that was upsetting his family. So as the man gets deeper into the woods, now he's walking towards the sound. He can't see anything, but he's walking towards the sound. And as he's walking towards this sound, he gets deeper and deeper into the woods and further away from his house. And he keeps hearing it. He's getting closer to it, and all of a sudden it stops. And so he kind of stops because he can't figure out, you know, where the creature went or why, you know, why it just suddenly stopped. Well, it was right around that time that he began to give up and head back to his house. You know, I guess he figures, I'm not going to find this thing. I was hot on the trail, but I lost it. Well, matter of fact, as he's heading back towards his house, he starts hearing the screams again. But this time, they're not coming from the woods. They're actually coming from his house. So he goes rushing back to his house, starts running towards his house. When he gets there, he finds his whole family had been killed. They had been torn to shreds by some sort of mysterious beast. He didn't know what to do. He goes to town to tell people what had happened, and fear sets in all over White Bluff. Other people around the town reported also hearing the howls and the screams of the mysterious creature, and over time, when they couldn't locate it, sort of, a reputation began to develop, and it sort of became known as the White Screamer, or to people outside of White Bluff, the White Bluff Screamer. Now, this is the story that I had always heard as a kid. People in White Bluff would tell you the story to try to scare you, okay? It was kind of a thing that people would kind of tell you. But then when you'd ask them if it was real, they would always say, yeah, I mean, yeah, we'd always heard it was real, but we don't think it's around anymore. You know, that's always the story that they would tell me. And so I had always wondered up if it was just a tale or if there was any truth to the story. So I started to reach out to some people that I knew that were like real true historians that had written a book about the town of White Bluff and about the history of White Bluff. Tony England had been a contributor to that book. And so, and then Edward England is another local historian. The England guys are all from White Bluff. And so I knew that they would be some good guys to go and ask. And I just happened to be good friends with both of them. And so when we sat down and I was asking questions about the White Bluff Screamer, they were really able to give me some good information. Tony England, let me start with him. Tony grew up in, well, he grew up actually over in Burns. But like I said, his family is historically from White Bluff, and he knows so much about the town. And he was aware of the White Bluff Screamer, and so we sat down to talk about it, and he told me that, you know, he's never really been able to find any historical evidence that the family was killed, so that you can't go back and find, like, any newspaper articles or things like that. But he said, you know, it's not all that uncommon for a really, you know, country area like this for something like that to happen. It may be not be recorded. But he said, you know, from what he's been told from people for many, many years, that this story is definitely true, and it's just a matter of, you know, talking to the right people to get some more information. He said that he had been hearing people talk about it for a long time. He said that there were reports back in the 1930s of a possible sighting by a couple, but he referred me over to Edward England Jr. and said, you know, ask Edward what he knows, because Edward had actually had a personal encounter. So I contact, his relative, Edward England Jr. He grew up in White Bluff, still lives in White Bluff, lived in White Bluff all of his life. And so I started to ask him about the White Bluff Screamer, and I said, look, I've talked to Tony about the White Screamer, and he said to contact you. He said that you may have had, you know, a personal encounter. And Edward told me, yeah, that there was definitely something that happened that he never could really explain. And so he started to go back into his memory for me, and he started to tell me a story about the 1940s. So we go back to the 1940s, and I asked him to describe the White Bluff Screamer, and he told me that, you know, no one really knows what it looks like, but he had always thought that it was a large cat-like animal similar to like a mountain lion. I asked him, you know, to tell me a little bit about this encounter, and he told me that that, you know, his father had told him about that story in the 1940s, but when he was growing up as a kid in the 1970s, his family had gone on a camping trip, and they had gone down to the creek, and his mother, father, sisters were all there, so it wasn't just him, you know, it was a whole family that recalls this story, okay? And they had heard a strange sound in the woods, so they're camping near the creek, you know, the famous creek where all this stuff happened, and they hear a sound in the woods. And, you know, a lot of people joke about the white screamer and things like that, but he says, you know, there was really something going on that night. There was something out there in the woods, and it kept getting closer and closer to us. And it got right behind a tree, only a few yards away. And they were all so frightened that they got in the truck and drove home, and they left all of their gear there. So they're camping. They've got everything set up. They've got their tents out, you know. They got everything ready to spend the night there. I mean, I'm sure they've gone to a lot of work of getting the camp set up and everything like that. And whatever it is in the woods spooked them so bad that they didn't even take the time to pack their stuff up. They left everything there, jump in the car, and go racing home. Now, I asked him about it. I said, you know, so, you know, what was that like? And he said, you know, I never actually saw it. But he said, when we went back to get the stuff, because they weren't just going to leave the stuff there, right? They were scared to death that night, but they were going to come back and get their stuff. So the next day they go back out there, right? They go back out there to pick up their camping gear, pack everything up. And he says when he did, he starts looking around, and he sees these really large cat-like paw prints. He said, you know, they were too big to just be a regular cat. I mean, they were big. They were something different, he said. But there was definitely some kind of prints that were left there the next day when he went back to get the stuff. Now, over the years, he told me that, you know, there were a lot of reports about this when he was young. Like he said, you know, relatives had told him, you know, back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and even to his encounter all the way up until the 70s, that it was a pretty commonly well-known kind of thing around there, that there was something out in the woods and that you kind of had to be careful. And for years and years, it was something that, you know, that was pretty well-known in that area. Tony says, you know, I asked Tony, what's the truth to the story? I mean, how truthful do you think the story is? Is this something people made up, or you think it's true? And he told me that he said, you know, while some people may have embellished certain parts of it, that it's definitely something that's based in truth. And it's something that had been around for a really long time. It wasn't just one or two people. It was something that kept coming up over and over with different people in different areas. But it all happened right around White Bluff and right around that creek. And so, you know, it's a story that is well known in this part. You know, it's a well-known legend. Some people will tell you it's completely fake. Other people will swear that they've heard a story or they know somebody that's encountered it. And, you know, it's tough to you know, sort the fact from fiction. But I think after talking to these two fellows who are the most well-known historians in White Bluff that you are going to find, I guarantee you that, somebody who's lived in this county my whole life, you're not going to find two guys who know more about the history of the county. And if they think that there's truth to it, I don't think anybody else should question it. There's got to be some truth to it. And it's a really interesting story. It connects to Montgomery Bell State Park and Werewolf Springs, which I know we'll talk about at some point. But there may be some connection there. I mean, it could be connected to Dogman. I mean, it could be a lot of things. I don't know if, you know, a lot of people know about this story. It's something that's sort of been contained to our area. So that's really why I'm so excited to be on the podcast with you guys tonight. It's because I'd love to have the opportunity to tell this story to other people outside of our little community here to see if anybody knows anything else that we may be able to connect it to be able to figure out really what's going on, because, you know, we know what we know, but there could be more out there.
Exactly. Now, Elijah, do you have some questions for Justin?
Well, actually, I do have a couple. Whenever I've heard about the story, there's always kind of been, let's see, sort of two variations. It's always been told, from what I've heard, is it may have been a Sasquatch, or it may have been more of a something of a supernatural apparition like nature. Do you have any comments on that? Because I've heard, like, been seen as like a white Sasquatch stalking around. I think I even heard a variation that after the father came back home and found his family dead, that there was big, large footprints burned into the floorboards, and he walked outside and seen it standing out in the grass, and it seems like there was footprints burned into the grass, too. It's been a little while, I'm sorry.
No, absolutely. I'm glad you brought that part of the story up, because there are different variations of the story, right? And I appreciate you bringing up that variation. You're absolutely right. There has been some connections with the Banshee, I've heard. There has been people who have said that they've seen, you know, what looked like a white figure that was like a spirit-looking thing that did burn marks into the ground. I have heard that as well. And when I first started researching that story, that was the version of the story that I had sort of read the most on the internet. But whenever I really got to talking to the locals here, the variation that I sort of read to you guys and sort of told to you from my notes, that's more of the variation that I've gotten from the locals. But there are definitely several stories that have been written up that do contain those other details. And so there are different variations. I know that there's been a lot of research done by different paranormal folks who, you know, are into that sort of thing, who have come down. I know I actually talked to somebody just earlier today, matter of fact, who said that there had been it was actually Tony England who had said that there had been some different college students that had come down from different universities, and they would come down to White Bluff, and they would go down to City Hall, and, you know, City Hall didn't know what to do, so they called Tony, who's the local historian, and, you know, so there has been a lot of people from all over the country that have come down to research this. Now, as far as what version of the story is true, I've heard both, but like I said, the ones from the locals in White Bluff that I was able to talk to that are in their 60s and 70s, who I consider to be, you know, kind of like primary sources, they told me that it was more like a cat and less like a werewolf or a spirit, but more like some kind of animal. Now, it wouldn't be like a regular cat. I mean, he said, you know, like an oversized bobcat or something like that. But that's what they told me. But I've heard the different variations of the story as well, and they're all very interesting to me. And, you know, who knows what the exact kind of story is. It could be kind of a mix of all of them, but I'm glad that you brought that up, because I tend to kind of gloss over that part of it because it wasn't as prevalent in my research, but there's definitely been other people who have found those facts and printed them. And like I said, the people from all over the country have come to White Bluff and checked in with City Hall and want to know more about this. And so, you know, the more that we can do to get the story out, the better, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
Exactly.
And
yes,
it seems like more often than not, the local renditions seem to be the more accurate renditions anyway, because, you know, they've always lived there their whole lives and they've heard it firsthand.
Well, you know, it's kind of like a game of telephone sometimes. You know, when you tell the story over and over, certain different things kind of get added in. And I think that's kind of what Tony was trying to tell me when he said, you know, maybe parts of it had been embellished. You know, maybe there was some truth to some marks being on the ground and something burned. Maybe there was, you know, a white glow around this thing. Who knows? I mean, there's probably some truth to a lot of it. And I'm one of those people who thinks that, you know, if there's a story going around, that there's probably some sort of truth to it, you know, because people don't just generally just make things up out of the air, right? But I think sometimes people do come up with stories and then sometimes they get misconstrued or maybe things get added to. But I definitely think there was something going on in White Bluff a long time ago, and there was some sort of creature out there in the woods. Now, was it a spirit? Was it a cat? Was it a werewolf? People are going to have different, you know, interpretations based on what they saw. But the fact that so many people saw something and it all kind of is similar tells me that there's definitely something that was going on. Now, they've told me, you know, nobody's had a sighting in a long time. Edward thinks, you know, if there was something there, that it probably died out at some point, maybe in the 70s or the 80s, because, you know, I'm like I said earlier, I'm 38 years old, so, you know, I kind of remember back to the mid-90s, and I don't remember anybody at that point actually seeing anything, but the legends at that point were definitely solidified.
You know, I find it really interesting that you mentioned – oh, sorry, John.
No, I was just saying right, and I agree. Yeah, please go ahead, Elijah.
I was just going to say, I found it really interesting that you brought up the cat-like details, and the reason I say so is because in my family's hometown and over in Dayton, Tennessee, there's a area over there close by called Sail Creek and Shipley Hollow Road, and that area is it's not well known, but there is a legend surrounding it. It's in a book or two out there, and it's known by the town. They'd call the area Pity Pat Holler, and in the 1800s, it was known to be just when it, night would fall on the land there, it'd just be pitch black. You couldn't hardly see anything. But there always was legend to be some sort of a creature out there that would follow people along the road, and that's how it got the name Pity Pat Holler, because when people walk through there at night, you could hear its feet kind of slapping against the road, kind of like a pity pat sound, like pity pat, pity pat. You could hear it following up behind you, stalking you. But it was kind of told to be almost cat-like in nature. But, you know, people be riding away on horses out of the area, and they'd jump on their horses with them or cause their wagon coming through the area to crash. And I think it was a mother and their kids that was riding in the wagon, and the mother died, and the two kids disappeared when it crashed. But people were terrified to go through the area, and even when my dad, who he actually lived on the road briefly, people wasn't ever really they weren't real thrilled to go out there at night, even in this modern area. It wasn't a big thing for them to be out messing around on that road at night. That's one way to say it. But even today, you can tell there's still some sort of legend surrounding it, because they've had big billboards along the main highway. It was some sort of a moving company, and it said basically, "We'll move anywhere, even Shipley Hollow Road." So there's still legend surrounding that, but I just thought it was real interesting because that was told to be some sort of a cat-like creature, and this is being told as a cat-like creature.
Well, you start to see these connections, right? And I've sort of noticed this myself, and I think that's why I became so interested in the story that I sort of mentioned at the beginning about the train going through Dixon County, because you hear about all these different creatures, right? And they're all connected with some sort of holler, and that all makes sense to me, why a creature would be in a holler down by the creek, because that's where the water is, right? But where did the creatures come from is what I keep wondering, you know. Where did they come from? And so ever since I've heard the story about, you know, the railroad, which makes sense to me. I mean, if you think about the land between the lakes and you think about this whole part of Tennessee, I guess everything from, you know, Nashville to the Tennessee River, if you're looking at a map, you got this big wide area. And really the only thing coming through that area way back in the late 1800s was the railroad. And, you know, when you look back in history and you look at these circuses and these different attractions that they had back in the late 1800s, I mean, it all matches up. You know, these different creatures that they would find. Some people say they get them from Europe and Asia and all these different places, and then they would breed them. I don't know. I mean, I don't know that much about it. I've just done some minor research. But what I've noticed is all these stories sort of connect. So you got this crazy circus train coming through the area. It crashes, right? And then some of the animals can't be found. And then for years, you hear all these mysterious stories. And I think it all connects. I really do. I think it all connects to the White Screamer. I think it connects to the Werewolf Springs story in Montgomery Bell State Park. I think it could connect to some of the stuff going on in Land Between the Lakes and Dogman. I mean, I'm just, the more that I'm starting to learn and understand about this stuff, the more that I'm starting to connect it and see how it all kind of interweaves. And I think we're getting closer and closer to maybe figuring out what it was.
Right. Now, and this is Dr. John. I've got a question for you. People say it's a cat-like creature. What is their evidence that it walked on all fours versus it was a bipedal and it walked like a human? Where did they get that story?
It's a good question. You know, I haven't talked to too many people who have actually seen the creature. Most of the people that I had talked to, you know, had heard stories about it, and it mostly came from a sound, you know. And I would say, is there any chance that this particular sound could have come from, you know, some other sort of animal? And they said, no, it's very unique, you know. And so I think that's kind of why some people kind of match it up with maybe it was a cat. We're kind of known in this area to have, you know, kind of mountain lion type animals. I mean, the high school that I teach at is we're the Dixon County Cougars, okay? And then in Burns at the middle school right down the road from my house, they're the Burns Bobcats. So we're sort of known in this area for big cats. So I'm not so sure if it's just because we're kind of have the, you know, we kind of have those animals in this area that people would mistake it for a cat? I'm not sure. You know, I've kind of always thought about that. As far as if anybody had seen it on the ground or up on all fours, kind of varies, right? Because nobody I've talked to has actually seen it, right? But some people have seen different things. Like I've talked to people who have said that they saw what looked like something on two legs, almost like a person. And those people usually describe the white sort of mist or the white glow, okay? They tend to say it's more looks like something that's standing upright, more like almost like a werewolf or something. But then sometimes I wonder, are they getting that mixed up with the Werewolf Springs werewolf, which I know we haven't talked about yet, but we will. And so I wonder sometimes if, you know, the fact that we've got big cats in the area and there's another story about a werewolf just 8 to 10 miles away, if people get things mixed up, right? So it's really hard for me to say. I don't really know, but I know that there was something out there, and I tend to think that it was probably some sort of a creature that was in that circus, or like we've speculated before, you know, different creatures breed and create new creatures. You know, who's to know if one of those creatures, you know, got off that train and went and breeded with another creature, and the next thing you know, we've got something new that nobody's ever seen before. I've kind of leaned more towards that theory myself. And so was it on all fours? Was it upright on two legs? I'm not sure. And I don't know if maybe it wasn't some sort of a hybrid creature. And, you know, a lot of things come to my mind. It's just one of those unanswered questions. But I do think that it does definitely get mixed in with some other things. So as far as people calling it a cat-like creature, I tend to think that that probably comes more from the reputation around here of big cats kind of being in the area. And I know recently I've seen on Facebook and other social media, people have been capturing like cougars and other big cats, you know, on their cameras. So I don't think it's a situation where they heard this thing and it was a big cat and they just mixed it up. But I do think that this weird thing that they were hearing, which was unlike anything else, may have been mistaken for a cat. Could be possible.
Okay, so basically it's a little bit legend and folklore that it might have been a four-legged animal, and there's not necessarily any proof that it wasn't a bipedal walking on two legs kind of thing, right?
No proof. Nobody really knows what it looked like. That's the thing. We know pretty definitively what it sounded like, right? Because there were multiple accounts of people hearing what it sounded like, and you know, different people would describe the same noise. So I think over the years we were pretty much able to kind of pinpoint on, okay, definitely the sound, it was a high-pitched, shrill, that was unlike any other animal in this area. You know, that was the thing. Because, you know, these old guys from around here, you know, old hunters and stuff like that, I mean, these are outdoorsmen that live in my area, you know. Nashville is a big city, but we live out here in the country. So most of these guys around here, you know, they're avid outdoorsmen. They know the difference between, you know, what a cougar sounds like and a bobcat and then, you know, some other animal that we don't know exactly what it is. They know the difference, you know, and these guys are not dumb when it comes to animals in the outdoors. Let me tell you, we're in Tennessee. They know what they're talking about, and they say, look, it was not a cougar, it was not a bobcat, it was something else. Now, did one of those creatures from that train, you know, breed with one of those and create something else? I don't know, but I definitely wouldn't rule out that it could be a bipedal you know, creature. Definitely can't rule it out.
Right. And I guess what I'll say to conclude on that line of questioning is that I have heard too many stories about Dogman. And in fact, I have a friend that dictated a story to me a couple of weeks ago, and that's going to be in an upcoming book that Elijah and I are trying to put together. And the point is, there are a lot of stories about Dogman in the area of Land Between the Lakes and then just west of Land Between the Lakes. It's kind of like a crescent, you know what I mean, that goes over toward Dixon County. And I think, you know, I just think there's a lot of room for exploration and trying to figure out what this is, because – you know, people say it's Dogman, and Dogman, from the stories that Elijah has told me, is a fairly vicious animal that tends to live in that area. And Elijah, would you mind describing a little bit about the Dogman from the stories that you heard from people and from some of your experiences?
From
the Beast of LBL, so to speak?
Yeah.
Okay. Sightings of a werewolf-type creature, as the story goes, has dated back to at least around the 1700s when French explorers were coming through the region of the Tennessee-Kentucky line is where Land Between the Lakes is at, but they would describe that there was a loup-garou in the region, which is French for, you know, French werewolf, and down further south around Louisiana, you have the rougarou, which is basically a variation of that, which is the same thing, but anyway. So you've had stories of a wolfman of sorts since around the 1700s, and even in today, modern society, there have been, at least since around, I think a little before 79 even, stories of a creature up in Land Between the Lakes killing, making people disappear, and, you know, generally causing mayhem up there. In 1979, gentlemen up there, and the North American Dogman Project tells this story. They have the interview with the gentleman. He worked for a Kentucky Fish and Game, and he was up there fishing around one of the bays up in the northern part of Land Between the Lakes. He was in a boat, and I think he said that it was early in the morning and the fog kind of started rolling in, and he was in a smaller boat, so he didn't want to get hit by one of the bigger boats that may be out further. So he went around closer to the shoreline, and he's floating along fairly close to the shore, and he's seen this couple. They were camping along the shore, but there's something off in the woods watching them, and he said he thought it was a horse at first, and the more he started looking at it, he could tell it wasn't it. He said it kind of looked like a hyena. It had a big mane on it and eventually stood up on two legs. And he started yelling at this couple, you know, cussing and screaming at them, trying to get their attention to look at this thing, but I guess they thought he was a nut job. They didn't ever look around. And he described that it pounced on him, held him down with his hands, specifically hands, and was taking bites out of them. And it terrified him so much that he peed himself, and he said, I just floated for I don't know how long. And he kept watching the news to see if anybody would mention it. And wouldn't you know, nobody ever did. It just kind of disappeared. And he didn't mention it because, you know, he worked for Kentucky Fish and Game. He didn't want to lose his job or anything like that. So he kept it to himself till he contracted or got cancer. And it was almost like a deathbed story. He told it. And the NADP, they have that interview if anybody wants to watch it. But that's one of the earlier stories from the region. And then you have the infamous family that got attacked and killed by the creature. You have that one. That would be the most famous one from up there. You got the gentleman who was a bow hunter who was up there, and they found his body in a soybean field up around the middle of the park. It's found in an area that we call Dark Hollow. That's not the official name, but we try to keep that area a little bit private. It's pretty good research area, but they found him dead in that soybean field, and something had partially eaten on him. Now, there are coyotes, there's red wolves, I'm sure there's big cats and even bear in the region, so it could have been something like that that ate on him, but that is what the story says that he was eating on. And, you know, there's plenty of stories of people who have seen something up there and got chased out, or there's even a gentleman who's driving up the trace in the middle of the night, and he said he seen what looked like a, you know, dogman running across the road along the trace, which the trace, let me back up there, is the road that goes from the north to the south part of Land Between the Lakes. Land Between the Lakes is the biggest inland peninsula in America, and the trace is the road that goes right between the middle. And he's seen this dogman run across the road and stand on the other side, and it stood there like it was waiting on something. And three little smaller versions of itself, three little pups ran across the road and followed it. And that's what he described. So the little pups seem to describe a physical living creature with a reproductive system. But yeah, there's a lot of interesting stories from Land Between the Lakes. You know, I've heard people describe it from stories that it looked like the werewolf from Silver Bullet. Or you have people describe it in description a little bit more like the Lon Chaney Wolfman, you know, a shorter muzzle and and whatnot. But, yeah, there's a lot of different descriptions up there. You got the gentleman who seen it, and it had a mane, and it looked like a hyena. You got the Jan Thompson description, which Barton Nunley drew a picture of that one. It's an interesting-looking thing. Y'all have to just look it up and see. Barton Nunley, Land Between the Lakes, Beast of LBL. But the gentleman who described that, he seen one that's almost described in similitude to the Lon Chaney Wolfman. He kind of described it looking like that, back and forth. But anyway, yeah, there definitely seems to be something up there. 2020, over the Elk and Bison Prairie, a gentleman reported seeing one walk across one of the trails up there. And that's very recent, so, you know, there's something still there. But it's such a big area, a big park, that it makes it difficult to do research because, you know, if there is something just running around wherever it pleases, that's a lot of territory to try to cover to research this thing. So that's what makes it the most difficult thing about researching an LBL.
Exactly. And I'd like to bring up a point. I brought this up in my book that's getting ready to come out called The Lizard Man Companion. And it's the concept of minimum viable population. In other words, how many entities or how many members of a species are required to continue the propagation of that species and for it to continue to live? Well, one theory, you know, I did a lot of research on this. The minimum number that I could find was that it would take 750, like Bigfoot. It would take 750 Bigfoot in an area to continue the population of Bigfoot. Now, you know, I'll tell you, Francis Marion Forest between Myrtle Beach and Charleston, I mean, you know, if there were 750 Bigfoot, you'd be tripping all over them. My goodness. So what that says is, well, where do they go? Why can we not see 750 Bigfoot? And that brings us, and, you know, I didn't know we were going to go this direction, but it seems to make sense. We're talking about the idea that maybe these beings are not always with us. It might be the case that they are interdimensional, and sometimes they're around us, and sometimes they aren't. But it does take at least 750 entities. It would take 750 dogmen to keep the population of dogmen alive. Now, Justin, have you heard of the minimum viable population theory?
Not a lot. Not enough to be able to explain it or anything like that.
Well, the whole point is, it's like, well, where do these guys go? I mean, you know, they're here and then they're not. You know, there was a white bluff screamer. Well, I mean, people heard it back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and maybe 50s, and where did it go? And I think that's a good question. Elijah, what do you think about that question and the idea of the potential interdimensionality of some of these creatures, some of these cryptids?
Well, I'll be honest with you, John. I think you have a couple of things going on. I'm a very devoted Seventh-day Adventist Christian, so I look at everything through the lens of a biblical aspect. You know, I think the Bible is the acid test for everything. And the way I view things, I see it a great controversy between good and evil, so to speak. So I think a lot of your Bigfoot dogman sightings are something of a spiritualistic nature, you know, Satan or a fallen angel trying to deceive somebody, confuse or terrify. And I think that would explain a lot of your sightings where they just vanish or people see them going through a portal because, you know, realistically, something of a demonic fallen angel nature, that would be something interdimensional. You know, they step in and out of our vision, our reality, so to speak. That'd be one way to explain it. So I think that's one way to describe some of the encounters people have. But I do maintain a belief in a physical creature, you know, because for one thing, in terms of Bigfoot, I've got hair samples that was analyzed at a laboratory. I got them from famous researcher Mary Green, three different bags of Bigfoot hair samples, and they came back as an undocumented primate. And if you want to go through like a historical example, you know, you got all these historical stories of people describing dog-headed men, and they describe them just as physical as you or me, like they have their own, I don't want to say culture, but or tribe even, but just a little clan, so to speak. You know, Alexander the Great, when he was conquering India, he described that back in letters to Aristotle, who was his teacher, that there's dog-headed men there in India. And I think he may have said that he encountered them in battle and fought them and possibly even captured some and used them as weapons. But Herodotus talks about the dog-headed men, Marco Polo, the Greek physician Ctesias. You got a lot of stories of something physical and alive. And even, I don't really know quite how to pronounce them, but if you go from like a Bigfoot aspect, you got historical encounters with something they would describe as the Blimmies, something like that. But they would describe them as being like headless men. They had the faces in the chest, and that sounds strange to connect that to Bigfoot, but in ancient artwork, you can see these hairy men with these faces in their faces in their chest, and a lot of your Bigfoot sightings will almost describe them as not having an actual neck, but like their head almost blends into their shoulders, and I think that could be potentially what was going on there. And, you know, Leif Erikson supposedly described seeing big hairy creatures over here, but I'm starting to get off on a historical tangent there, but that's really how I view things, my point of view on the matter.
Well, it sounds like you kind of agree with the fact that they may be here today and they may not be here later, and then they might reappear. Is that correct?
To a certain degree, if you go from like a biblical spiritualistic aspect, but I do feel like there's something physical that's always here around as well. But, you know, think of all the acreage that's in the United States. You know, you got across the interstates, you look on the left and the right sides of the roads, it's just forest for as far wide as you can see. You know, there's not a lot of people that's going to be going through there. And at nighttime when these things come around, people are generally in their houses, they're in bed, and they really get active about 12 o'clock at night to about 4 or 5 in the morning when there's not a lot of people around, so that there's not a whole lot of room for a lot of sightings, so to speak. Now, that there are sightings in the daytime, too, I will add that, but to a great degree, they're nocturnal creatures, so to speak. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, okay, that's a very interesting way of looking at things, and those are some good observations, and we certainly appreciate them. And Justin, I'll tell you what, now we're getting near our witching hour of the top of the hour. We got 7 minutes left in this podcast. So, Justin, we're going to give you the last word on this topic. So the floor is yours, sir.
Well, I just appreciate you guys having me on. You know, this is a story that I've grown up with, actually several stories that I've grown up with. And, you know, I've always just found them to be really fascinating and interesting. And, you know, I'd never really heard a lot of the other stuff that you guys are saying. I've done a little bit of research on it, but I never really heard a lot of this stuff. And the more that I hear it, the more I feel like it all kind of connects in some way. And definitely your different theories about, you know, the spiritual, the physical, it has me thinking about this whole story in a new light tonight. And that's what I really appreciate about you guys. It's something I've sat down and thought about for a really long time. And, you know, I think sometimes when you kind of get pigeonholed on something, you look at it a certain way. But after talking to you boys tonight, I'm really starting to think about some different possibilities. And, you know, I appreciate the opportunity to tell our little part of the what I feel like is a bigger overall story here, so that maybe we can figure out and connect it all together. And again, just thank you for letting me come on and being able to share this, because I feel like we're getting closer to maybe figuring out what it is. And I'd like to see kind of, you know, what other facts are out there and things like that. But It's a fascinating story, and I'm really looking forward to telling you guys the other part to it, which I think connects, which is about Werewolf Springs, which is an actual place, an actual spring that is here right down the road from my house here at the Montgomery Bell State Park. And another story that connects to everything that we're talking about tonight that also connects. And so it's just all fascinating, guys. And I appreciate you guys bringing me in on this thing and allowing me to sort of share our part of it, because it all connects somehow.
You know, it really does. And I think the more we talk and the more we discuss, whether we're on the air on a podcast or we're just sitting around talking, the closer we'll get to the truth. Now, Elijah, do you agree with that?
Well, hopefully so. I mean, you know, we can only hope that we'll reach a conclusion of this at some point. You know, people have been at it a long time, and we can only hope that we'll close in on some good evidence at some point. You know what I mean?
Well, I think we will. I think the more people that are involved with this, and I've got a story in 3 weeks. In 3 weeks, I hope, and I'll talk with you, Elijah, about this. We can talk about the Vampire Hotel, and that is is an explosive story. And Justin, maybe you can join us on that one, because I have uncovered some of the most amazing facts about the Vampire Hotel. And it seems like there's a big disconnect between the people that know these facts and know the stories and know about the trial and everything, and the people that experienced it up there inland between the lakes. And I don't think anyone has really put the pieces together. And I think that's really what we're trying to do with this series of podcasts. Or maybe we're just trying to develop more questions, which is, you know, which is not a bad thing. So, you know, we'll get together next week, and you know, Justin, we'll talk about Werewolf Springs and some other things. And
I'm very excited for that.
So Justin, will you be with us next week?
Oh, absolutely. You know, like I said before, you know, I just appreciate you guys bringing me in, because I feel like we're starting to connect all the dots here. And that's, you know, as a historian and a guy who does a lot of research, I mean, that's when you're trying to figure out anything. I mean, you've got to sit down, you got to put your evidence on the table, and you got to talk and let people discuss. And it's just been a lot of fun. And I can't wait to tell everybody about Werewolf Springs, because it's definitely my favorite story of all time from this area.
Oh, that is a hell of a story. It really is. And so, Elijah, will you be back with us as a co-host?
I plan to, my friend. I can't stay away from something Werewolf Springs related. It would be against my nature. I love the story too much.
Well, that's great. Well, I tell you what, everyone, we have had a lot of fun tonight. I think we have. We've talked about topics. We've talked about legends. We've talked about potential explanations. We've talked about all kinds of things. And the whole purpose of this is to bring the questions out so that we can start answering them. And I think the more questions we put on the table, that leads us to better answers. So I want to say thanks, everybody, for being here on this special ScaryCast of Land Between the Lakes, Part 1. Our guest was Justin Spurlock, co-hosts. Of course, Elijah Henderson and Dr. John Stamey. And we'll see you next time, same bat channel, 9 p.m. next Thursday night. And by the way, if you want to listen to it, it's a permalink, so you can always click on the link and you can always listen to it. So anyway, thanks a lot, and we'll be back with you next week. So have a great one, and we'll see you next time, okay?
Have a great one, gentlemen.
Thank you, guys.
Okay, take care.
See you next week.